Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up today, we'll talk about Shopko for the first time in a long time. We'll discuss at-home earnings from Kroger and Michael's stores as well. A reminder to like us and rate us wherever you do find us. And also, we're on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we'll launch right into this one, Leighton, and Shopko leading off our stories. They hit our radar for the first time in a long time this week as they announced plans to close a slew of underperforming stores throughout the North and Midwest. Now, Shopko is privately held, so this story gives us a rare opportunity to discuss something other than earnings during a busy earnings season, especially at a time when staple retailers are doing a great job at drawing customers for holiday shopping. Maybe a bit of a different story, though, for Shopko. They're based in Wisconsin. They do business in two dozen states. And at the time of this announcement, the Sun Capital-owned retailer operated 363 stores, but that number may change downward.
Yeah, it's going to change downward and by double digits, as you mentioned. But Shopko has been through it all over the last few decades. This is a company we haven't talked about a whole lot, but this is actually a favorite of ours, as they have expanded and then contracted repeatedly over the last couple of decades. Different management teams and different ownership stakes have really sent the company in varying directions. And as a result, you see a different strategy employed every 3 to 5 years. And one of the strategies that the company has embarked on was to actually expand the smaller Shopko hometown concept throughout the Midwest. And so we saw a lot of built-to-suits, and we saw a lot of Shopko taking over and renting buildings that were once occupied by the now defunct Alco stores. In addition, a few years ago, management decided, like I was trying to say, to strike development deals, very expensive, I might add, development deals, multi-million dollar build-to-suit projects, long-term leases, and we were scratching our heads as to why, because these markets, while they were maybe underserved because they're smaller markets with not a lot of general retail, especially after Alco left, and some of these markets hadn't yet had a Dollar General, still very expensive. The type of builds they were doing were indicative of maybe a larger market with more than 50,000 people. Instead, these are markets with less than 5,000 people. Fast forward a couple years, and even with smaller Dollar General stores having taken hold in a multitude of rural markets in the Midwest, Dollar General is still expanding by the hundreds, whereas Shopko, not so much. They operate, again, in some of the same regions throughout the Midwest. They have just not seen a lot of success. And I think a lot of that has to do with, and we'll get into the details here, how they operate on a store-by-store basis. Dollar General, by the way, while not always having the same variety of soft goods as maybe Shopko Hometown, has kept prices low and invested in those prices. And by the way, they have more consumables over the last couple of years, a strategy they have not been shy about to their shareholders. They say that food is a number one expansion point for their business. This has helped to grow an average basket size for Dollar General and, by the way, Family Dollar as well. And while we do not see sales comps for Shopko, because they are privately held, their larger hometown stores have reportedly had a hard time in terms of unit profitability. So just like any other retailer, they look at profitability on a per unit basis. Between rent, utilities, and other related costs along their thinly sliced supply lines, it's created an environment of higher price points, especially when compared to Dollar General or Family Dollar, who have much better buying power. And that's why their cost of goods is where it's at, because they have thousands of stores throughout the United States, whereas Shopko, like we said, only has a few hundred. However, at the same time, their lease rates in rural areas are well beneath market averages, again, in some of the areas they operate in, since they are often the only retailer that would move into such locations that have been long-standing with over 18,000 square feet. Even at these reduced rates, though, it seems they struggle to maintain profitability. So some of these locations may be only spending $40,000 a year in lease, yet are only breaking even. So that is an inherent problem to Shopko, and that really tells you why they are closing some stores down. According to DebtWire, Shopko asked some more prominent vendors for discounts over the last few months on some merchandise, And this is actually going to tie into some other retailers we're talking about. But Shopko, let's just put it bluntly, does not have the buying power of some larger staple retailers that are able to leverage the more prominent suppliers throughout the United States. It's unclear if they were looking to pass these savings on or simply get a better gross margin to keep the lights on and address the other increasing expenses they have going on. We did note on an episode much earlier in the year that a series of softline vendors got a letter from Shopko pretty much demanding a reduction in the price of goods. Our background focus on the Hometown banner is intentional, as the retailer's latest closing announcement includes the Hometown banner in all but one of its 39 planned locations. Again, 39 locations planned to be closed. At this point, the Hometown banner does make up the majority of their stores after a series of closings for their larger square foot stores in markets such as Omaha over the last few years.
Now, the company has not filed for bankruptcy, which leads us to an important question of the one-time closing-related costs. And since they're not benefiting for normal bankruptcy protections, chances are good that they're going to have to pay off lease balances or settle with landlords as they exit agreements prematurely. And we would like to think the timing was opportune and lined up with a significant portion of lease renewals. But with 39 total locations closing, this is unlikely that all the leases lined up for this exact period of time. And this is something that Leighton and I have kind of known had been in the pipeline. We had some information from those in the know kind of regarding their real estate holdings and thinking that they may not renew leases in certain places or may let the leases expire in other locations. Now we're seeing that come to fruition, maybe a bit earlier, though, than we thought. Even though the company is following the guidance of outside counsel here, we have to question basically where the company goes from here. Shutting down locations that are underperforming, look, that's a normal piece of business for a retailer, especially one that's struggling a little bit on the bottom line, but they have to address at some point the larger issue that is inherent to their business. And to us, as much as we may like the name of the retailer, in terms of operationally, we don't see a clear path for financial redemption here. A few things need to take place to increase average basket, including a better product assortment. Oftentimes, we talk about more capital investments into the actual stores. Even though many of these Hometown stores are basically the only game in town, they're starting to leech market share away to the Dollar Generals and Family Dollars of the world who are making those capital investments to the stores. To Leighton's point earlier, those stores are making more investments towards food and perishables and other items. And for Shopko, more low-cost items and more areas for refrigerated goods could be a start. I went to a Shopko Hometown store recently, in fact, about a month and a half ago, and they had built out their refrigerated goods section. The problem was, four of their refrigerators were completely inoperational, so they weren't stocked with goods. They had nothing in them. They were completely turned dark, and that's just not a very good use of internal store square footage. If you're going to put the refrigerators and freezers in there, they're going to be burning off the electricity and taking up the floor space. The least you could do is stock them, or if they're inoperational, make sure they get to that capacity where they are operational. Even though, you know, you might be a little bit slim in terms of the amount of money you have to spend, look, Sun Capital, a large company, they've got a lot of money there. And in order sometimes to make a retailer successful or to get a rebound at a retailer, you've got to put in money. Look at what Macy's has done with their recent turnaround, if you can call it that, and their return to respectability in the retail space. Now, the reason Shopko may have to focus more on their selection is that overall customer traffic in many of their remaining Hometown locations, it's going to be capped. A lot of these locations are in towns of 2,000-3,000 people in some cases, surrounding areas of only about 10,000 people. And in smaller markets where there's only a couple of general merchandise retailers, usually Dollar General, Family Dollar, the other two, you can only gain so much market share. Basically, you're just depending on people being born or people moving to that town in order to gain market share. And in fact, a lot of your market share is going to be predicated on which side of town the store is in. So if you're in a population center of the town that's kind of away from the Dollar General, you may have a benefit. In the case of the Hometown store I went to, literally right across the street from a Dollar General. So in that case, they can't benefit from which side of town the store resides in. And you've got to differentiate yourself using other mechanisms. Now, from what details we have, the restructuring is looking at how best to boost margins for their existing business long term, not how to grow and get better as an organization in the 21st century. This is something that Sears focused on ad nauseum, was the fact that they wanted better margins overall rather than growth and improvement overall as an organization. And this is one of the reasons why the Shopko announcement is concerning for us, in that they do have the benefit of serving a particular underserved subsegment of the United States, in a segment of the United States that, to be honest with you, is a little bit immune, not completely immune, but a little bit immune from that e-commerce coverage, in part because you look at Amazon's next day shipping or 2 day shipping. Well, if you live in a small town in what others would classify as kind of the middle of nowhere, a lot of times that 2 day shipping turns into 5 day shipping. And I hear that from a lot of our listeners that live in rural areas that say, hey, look, you know, 2 day shipping is great through Walmart, Target, Amazon, but it's simply not realistic for a lot of rural areas in the United States. And they're kind of an afterthought compared to some of the larger cities. So doing business for Shopko in towns that are often left out of those 2 day shipping guarantees is a benefit for Shopko. The problem is we don't see a necessary path to profitability for them if they don't reinvest in their organization, if they're just focused on cost cutting. And one thing we do see, Leighton, is evidence of how this can work in smaller to mid-sized markets and auto parts retailers, where AutoZone has noted growing pains in themselves in trying to serve loosely populated areas of the Midwest. Oftentimes, they're content to open up those brick and mortar stores in these smaller towns because they know it gives them advantage over their competitors. That's something that Shopko has because they already have that brick and mortar advantage in a lot of rural Midwest and northern towns. But in this case, we're just not seeing it bear fruit for whatever reason.
You've done a good job in laying out how Shopko should go forward, or at least think in terms of the long-term investment horizon. So they're going to have to remain sustainable, at least for the remaining locations. And there are different ways, to your point, as to how to accomplish this sustainability. If Shopko could somehow partner with someone in the e-commerce space or grow with current digital ambitions, they could be local hubs for merchandise pickup or online returns in these small local areas. Think about that. There's no general merchandise area in these rural communities that offer this sort of shipping hub. So think about what Kohl's has been doing with Amazon in that partnership. Why could they not do the same sort of thing? This could drive traffic and this could drive basket size. Something, to your earlier point, Trent, is extremely hard to accomplish when your population in that rural area is fairly stagnant. Recent studies have shown that rural customers often still shy away from digital orders because of the concern of sending damaged or defective items back more easily. That's always a concern, especially in these smaller communities. And looking at all of the 19 states where they're closing these up to 39 stores, you look at Shopko hometown here, and they are certainly going to be closing in a select few communities that are going to be left without a larger brick and mortar presence, such as Shopko hometown, and could therefore, you know, certainly fit the description of an area that doesn't have access to the popularized expedited shipping that Amazon and Walmart offers. Shopko, for what it's worth, during the last few months, they have invested heavily and reformed its website, shopko.com. They now have a number of items for sale on there and have also taken the time to promote their loyalty reward program on there, which, by the way, gives 3% back in rewards in a system not tied directly to a company branded credit card. So they are trying different things to at least boost average basket. Again, transaction may be a different story, but the last thing we would like to see in terms of initiatives going forward for Shopko is potentially growing out their pharmacy division. So a lot of their hometown stores do have pharmacies, but a lot don't. Adding pharmacies in locations without one, or advertising more for the remaining locations that do have pharmacies. Retail pharmacies are growing at a fast pace, as we all know, as we've covered the earnings reports from CVS and Walgreens. And the momentum is strong for the coming years. If you look at all of the data coming in saying that retail pharmacy sales are going to be exploding between now and 2030, I think those numbers are fairly accurate. Shopko hometown most likely doesn't carry the same profitability as maybe the larger retail pharmacy divisions like CVS or Walgreens, but they can gain that market share in the areas in which they do business. And so really, in our opinion, they have no excuse to not keep or grow the markets where they have no meaningful competition coming in, no regional pharmacy players in that space. And by the way, we do have to talk about the dates. We said 39 closings, all of them All of these affected stores are going to close by the end of February, so fairly soon. This was in a report from Michelle Hansen, Shopko's manager of public relations. And as far as employees are concerned, they are offering transfers for employees that are close to other Shopko locations. However, again, many of these locations are in rural markets, so it's going to be hard for those employees, theoretically, to travel 30 plus miles to the next location. But for those employees that aren't going to be able to transfer to other locations for work, severance packages are going to be offered. And while this is yet another expense that most bankrupt retailers can avoid, they don't often have to pay out severance packages, although you have seen that a little bit with Sears here and there. Shopko is doing the right thing by providing something in the short term for its displaced workforce. And because of the different store footprints, by the way, there are a wider range of employees that are being affected per location, between 10 and 25 per location, both a mix of part-time and full-time workers.
Well, let's move on to a different retailer now in At Home, their home goods retailer that we once thought might be in trouble since their IPO, but they released earnings for their fiscal 2019 third quarter this week, and the retailer has done far better in the last few quarters than we would have ever anticipated and a lot of other analysts would have ever anticipated. Now, we talked about a small format extension with Shopko that may still be too big in terms of square footage for your own good, and here we have the retailer At Home who is known to take over buildings well over 80,000 square feet, about the size, in fact, of a full-line Shopko in size, despite having extremely limited product categories. In fact, there's an At Home near me that's well over 100,000 square feet in terms of size. And while seasonal is a huge part of an ever-evolving e-commerce space, as well as furniture and home goods, At Home's business has really taken advantage of their use of displays during the last few months of the year. Often they devote massive areas to the sales floor for Halloween decorations, an area that served as a huge opportunity for those interested to dabble a little bit more this year. We'll talk about that in regards to Michaels and the benefit Michaels saw later on in the show. Let's get to the numbers. The company was once again profitable with 18 cents per diluted share coming in. This was a 3 cents beat versus Zacks' consensus investment estimate. This nearly tripled what they brought in last year, backing management's growing track record. Now, they beat on earnings per share last quarter too, by the way, after again struggling not too long ago in terms of analyst beat and trying to beat analyst numbers. The home furnishings merchandiser brought in total sales of $267 million, coming in $55 million higher than last year's third quarter. Halloween, but also early Christmas sales helped seasonal areas of the store. Now, same store sales increased a very healthy 5.2%, with this being their 19th straight quarter of positive comps. A modest beat on the top line, but nevertheless, they have managed to beat average Wall Street figures over the last four quarters now, indicating strong consumer sentiment and the low to mid-single digit increases in discretionary income that we've seen tracking as of late. Now, as a reminder, those who come out with the data have been saying that year-over-year increases in customer discretionary funds will most often trickle down to the tune of 70 to 80% to retail, especially during this time of year. Retail trade as a percentage of GDP has fluctuated only a little in the last couple of years, coming in between 5.5 to 5.6% of total GDP. Now, shares of At Home, ticker HOME, H-O-M-E, fell over 14% on Thursday despite the strong financial report. You might be asking why. Well, a single-digit loss could be chalked up to a bad market day or a slight misunderstanding. A double-digit move here, especially in a day when markets were relatively even on Thursday, usually indicates something much worse, Leighton.
Yeah, whether it's sandbagging or not, At Home was rather hesitant to be boastful about the upcoming fourth quarter. Really had us really scratching our heads because over the last few quarters, like we just noted, strong financial results from this company that is really a growth company, a growth story that we just did not see coming. In fact, a lot of analysts that talk retail were saying that they didn't even know why At Home would have an IPO in the first place. Yes, despite sales at their competitors being at all-time highs, management seemed a little insecure, but nevertheless, we have to look in as to why management was a little hesitant about being bullish on the upcoming fourth quarter. We look at their competitors, and their competitors have been doing very, very well. And while their competitors, maybe you could say they aren't hyper-focused on the home goods arena, still, revenues at all-time highs in a number of outlets. You think of Ross and TJ Maxx, they sell home goods too, just on a much, much smaller scale. Target mentioning home goods being a very good category for them over the last few months. Management seemed a little insecure, however, and this has to do with scale. At home, management talking about the upfront cost of doing business, namely transportation and tariff pressure. So you think of a retailer like Target, like I just mentioned, or Walmart, massive scale, massive buying ability for their supply chain. But also, if the cost of fuel goes up, they can really tuck their tail between their legs and continue onward. They don't really have a short-term deviation from their plan because of short-term fuel pressures. Also, port delays. They were saying that their merchandise is getting delayed to their distribution centers because of certain delays at the port, something we have only talked about once in the recent past, or actually over 2 years ago too, when some retailers had talked about delays related to dock worker strikes. A lot of people wanting more money who work on the docks. But right now it's related to congestion. A lot of merchandise coming in on these ports, and it's affecting At Home's business and their business model going forward. But what was most interesting about this most recent pullback, or this immediate pullback in the stock price, was the issues that management has talked about here is pretty much everything analysts were already privy to. So at least one could assume these types of things were going to affect their business. Maybe not port delays, but transportation costs. These transportation costs are inherent to the business model of At Home. And this is something we've seen over the last couple of quarters with other retailers. So for analysts to scratch their heads and not expect this, that's a little bit interesting for us. And for one, At Home does significant buying for product manufactured in China. So if we're talking about port delays, a lot of people could see that coming. And for two, their growing store count is making forays into new territories, new states altogether. They do business in over 30 states now, making transportation routes inherently inefficient. Because if you think about the number of distribution centers they have, the current stores that they already operate in, well, they're actually straying away from that. So these are going to be longer routes. And guess what? If fuel prices go up, it's going to be much more expensive to run their day-to-day business. And so think about those two things. And then you go back into the business and you say, well, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. That's actually something that we could actually see happening. And it's not like these costs are getting out of control. Management is just saying, listen, this is what to expect for the fourth quarter. They're doing the right thing by telling analysts and the shareholders on the call that these are the worries that they have going forward. Not that the business is crashing and going to zero anytime soon. And I speak of their new stores and how they're entering into new territories altogether. The company had 29 net new stores during the quarter. This increase has definitely helped those robust top line increases. But again, it comes at a particular cost. And for us, this expansion does seem sustainable, though. The fact that the third quarter was plenty strong in the face of the aforementioned cost pressures proves that management's internal guidance was more or less dead on. And from their earnings conference call to analysts, they said that new store productivity was, and I quote, exceptional. So those new stores, even though they're far away and it's expensive for their trucks to get to, still doing very well from the top line perspective. And gross margins went up, by the way, as there was not a huge move for the direct cost of goods themselves, which is great. Therefore, the increase in margins was tied to getting customers to pay a little bit more for their goods that they sell at their stores. So they're able to pass some price increases onto their customers successfully, which is always something you want to see in terms of a growing business, and something hard to achieve in the discretionary goods arena with players like Wayfair.com offering shipping promotions around this time of the year and far more variety in some cases online. But that in-store experience, something that Trent alluded to with their seasonal categories, is something you simply can't trade for. I think that At Home really does, after all, have a successful niche in this category.
So we noted the year-over-year store count growth, but failed to say that it is representative of over 20% more stores at the company. So we're talking about a company with relatively few existing stores. So the company growing their absolute size of sales floor space at a truly astounding rate. They now have 173 stores in a whopping 36 states. So you talk about a spread out young retailer. It's really what we're looking at here, really giving the Container Store a run for their money in this category, as they have over 90 much smaller stores for the Container Store, but just as spread out. Of course, it's not apples to apples, as the Container Store has been focused on their so-called stores of the future, where prototypes are centered more on closet and organizational experts, sometimes lesser square footage there. Anyway, regardless, we do have to give credit where credit is due, as At Home has maintained a relatively strong operating margin in the face of rapid expansion, and paying those expensive overtime wages to the workers helping in the effort. At the end of the quarter, they had over 25% more in inventory. And if we compare to the 20.1% increase in stores, we see that they really are prepping for what they perceive to be a strong end of the year shopping spree for its customers and making sure they don't sell out of promotionally priced merchandise anytime soon. Of course, they've got this hybrid model where it's almost off price, but not really off price as what you see in home goods at price points are a little bit higher. Still, given their space in the market, really something where we feel like bolstering inventory levels may be valuable, but at the same time, we're talking about a retailer that doesn't carry a lot of any one particular item, so it may be difficult even then to attain customer satisfaction even with the inventory they're carrying. They do point to advertising in the right areas as being key to spread the word in new and existing markets that they're opening up in. And that's actually an expense that went up in this latest quarter given those new store openings. Also, to drive a potentially better inventory turn at their stores, they implemented a rewards system last year that was said to be paying dividends this quarter in terms of consumer insights. Didn't really mention it in terms of boosting the sales, but they're talking about at least the data that they're churning out from it. They label this program, by the way, as Insider Perks, and that enrollment continues to exceed management's expectations, now sits at 3.5 million members as they have more functionality with the program, such as digital receipts and real-time in-store feedback as well. Now, despite certain statements during the call about costs going into the fourth quarter, they did reiterate guidance for revenue, profit, and adjusted earnings expansion. So that brings us back to the shares as they fell another 14% in trading on Friday. This left shares of the company at $20.41 by week's close. And again, while we didn't think the earnings call was necessarily stellar, we did wonder as to why there were these couple of double-digit shed-offs there. Now, granted, trading on Friday was light anyway, as there was a larger market sell-off. We'll talk about that when we get to Kroger and Michaels as well and how that affected their share prices. But shares of At Home year-to-date are off about 35%. They saw highs over $40 in July. Those were all-time highs for the company since their IPO in summer of 2016 when shares hovered in the mid-teens. And as we do now with the number of retailers, we always like to compare market valuation with that of the struggling JCPenney. So At Home's market cap, even after an extremely rough week in trading, even though they have fewer than 200 stores, is just over $1 billion. JCPenney, you ask? Well, $423 million in market capitalization. Coming up after the music, we'll get to earnings reports from Kroger and Michaels, but we're going to go beyond the numbers because we're interested in the initiatives that Kroger and Michaels will be rolling out to stores over the next few quarters to keep an eye on. And of course, we'll talk food inflation, the ever-present topic of food inflation when it comes to Kroger. Well, Kroger released earnings this week, and the reaction was initially mixed on Thursday before the stock ended up improving by the end of the trading day. One headline we read early Thursday said, and I quote, "Kroger crushed after missing revenue estimates." Even though the stock at the time was only down 0.4%, the stock was down slightly more than that, granted, in pre-market trading, but that same media outlet changed its tune and later its headline online later in the day after Kroger ended up with a modest increase in share price during trading on Thursday. Shares ended Thursday at $29.56, up from $28.63 in Tuesday's trading. Keep in mind, market was, of course, closed on Wednesday for the National Day of Mourning for George H.W. Bush. They ended the week at $29.17, so down a little bit from Thursday after a day of larger market sell-offs on Friday where all three indices took a pretty big hit. But we were, of course, you know, aside from being interested in the financials, which we're always interested in, we're more interested in the trends noted on the earnings call. Among the things we were watching carefully for were margin discussion, updates surrounding food inflation, and of course, their use rates for digital channels. Kroger had an extremely transparent earnings call, answered all analysts' questions as completely as they could given the data that they had. And so we'll get to that later, but first, Layton's got the actual earnings portion.
Definitely a breath of fresh air if you ever have a second to actually listen to the entirety of the earnings call. Kroger management did an excellent job of going into detail through every question that was asked by analysts. But going to the numbers, perhaps the most impressive number as far as analysts were concerned was the earnings per share figure. Analysts expected earnings to fall over last year's third quarter, coming in at 43 cents per share. However, Kroger earnings rose slightly despite continually compressed margins, with their adjusted earnings per share coming in around 48 cents. Same store sales did miss a little bit, with analysts expecting a 1.8 increase and the retailer coming in with a 1.6% increase in comps. And this, by the way, excludes fuel, which, as with most retailers who dabble in the fuel arena, they usually do. Think Costco, think Walmart. However, while we aren't impressed by this number, the same store sales figure, it's not tremendously disappointing either, especially when you think back to the statements 5-6 quarters ago, people saying that expect to see negative comps at Kroger, the nation's largest grocer. Let's keep in mind that the retail giant, even Walmart, whose same-store sales increases were north of 3% in their latest quarter in North American sales, noted stagnation in food prices to remain highly competitive. Analyst same-store sales for Kroger didn't change notably after this, so you have to take that into consideration. And as such, when adjusted for merchandise mix and inflation, Kroger's 1.6% boost in same-store sales doesn't actually look all that bad, though we'd still like to see numbers closer to that 2% range. Basically, this is just suggestive that much of the increase is organic rather than driven by general inflation. In fact, CFO Mike Schlottman said that about 11 basis points of inflationary impact was seen from the retailer, relatively slim compared to the general merchandise areas, some that we just talked about with at home, the home goods retail industry is actually experiencing a little bit more inflation in some cases than grocery inflation. Can't believe we're saying that. For comparison, including pharmacy, the impact jumps up to 22 basis points. Schlottman mentioned that much of the deflation they saw in certain categories was essentially a product of Kroger working with suppliers to keep costs down. Once again, a theme that's starting to occur in this podcast, the economies of scale for both Kroger and Walmart. These are benefits that are inherent now to their business model because of just the sheer scale that they have in terms of being able to really bully suppliers around. But what about those trends we were looking at? Trent mentioned that we're going to dive a little bit deeper into this Kroger story. In terms of margins, CEO Rodney McMullen chose to focus largely on new initiatives that may actually boost margins long term. In particular, he noted within 2 minutes of the call starting that their 84/51 partnership, and more specifically, their Kroger Precision marketing efforts underneath this partnership, is seeing a 150% year-to-date increase in revenue. He and the rest of the leadership team were bullish in framing this as an opportunity to grow margins away from their standard business of selling groceries to the common consumer. McMullen said that they are effectively moving from a traditional retail model to, and I quote, a growth company model with new initiatives. And he said gross margins from alternative revenue streams is significantly higher than their core business, again, of selling groceries and consumer goods. The advertising mechanisms they trumpet take place both online and in brick and mortar locations for many of the same brands that they actually sell. Their online advertising boasts click-to-conversion rates 2 to 3 times better than the industry standard. Again, this is according to their CEO. Kroger Personal Finance, a division that is fairly new, has also borne out margins above that which is normally seen in the grocery portion of their business. So Trent, a lot going on with this business, but we do have to shift gears and talk about what they do business in terms of what brings in the most top-line revenue day-to-day for them.
So yeah, a lot of talk on this earnings call about margins coming from the non-grocery part of their business, but what about margins on their traditional product? Well, higher margins on fuel help to offset margin stagnation on food. However, they feel as though they've at least gotten a little bit of a hold on shrink, with their shrink rate alone helping to offset, again, some otherwise tepid margin growth. They were also careful to note that their margin excluding fuel was up sequentially over the second quarter, despite what they call investing in price. In other words, keeping prices low at the cost of margins in order to drive unit sales at the stores. And after fielding a question about the price investments, McMullen noted build out of 2 new warehouses that also negatively impacted overall margins, but they feel like will help to boost those margins in the future with the new up-to-date warehouses. Warehouses, something that's a constant trend, something that it seems like we're talking about a lot with both general merchandise and food-based retailers in trying to update that technology in order to drive margins in the future. Now, on to digital sales, another thing that we mentioned we were going to be looking at the call carefully for. The grocer actually outpaced Walmart from a growth perspective. Now, not in terms of an overall movement perspective of items and overall revenue from digital channels, but digital channel sales for Kroger grew over 60% in the third quarter over last year's third quarter. More notably, their coverage area, they say, now reaches over 90% of Kroger households, which is up big time over the last couple of years. That includes both pickup and delivery. Now, this is likely to exclude some of those rural areas, the same rural areas we were talking about with Shopko. Those have smaller footprint locations. I've been to some Kroger locations that are actually right around 10,000 to 15,000 square feet in more rural areas. Dillon's and Gerb's among the divisions for Kroger most impacted by this particular phenomenon. But as they continue to roll out this program, they hope to have it to 100% of their customers, or in other words, 100% of their stores in the U.S. Now, part of this increase was bolstered by Kroger Ship, which is now available in all of their myriad divisions. So they've got a lot of different banners underneath their overall Kroger banner. We mentioned, of course, the likes of Dillon's, Gerb's, but also Ralph's on the West Coast, King Soopers, and Smith's in the Mountain West. Their goal with the digital sales here, once again, as stated in their Investor Day earlier this year and restated now in the call, is to reach 100% of their customers. But on top of that customer part, they want to eventually reach the entire U.S. population. Now, reaching 100% of their customers may simply just require some additional updates in older, smaller rural locations. Granted, we're also seeing some smaller rural locations close down as the concept kind of outgrows these rural markets. However, reaching the entire U.S. population, especially with site-to-store initiatives, would require substantial build-out of their brick-and-mortar footprint, or at least buyouts of smaller local chains, which they've kind of put on the back burner over the last couple of years with the aforementioned 8451 acquisition and the divestment of their independent fuel centers. We saw a couple of years ago, of course, the Harris Teeter acquisition, as well as the Roundy's acquisition up in the northern United States. But since that point, Kroger hasn't been very bullish about buying up local chains like that. And growing areas like Northwest Arkansas, which would be a great example, are left untouched by a nearby Kroger store. And you might say, well, yeah, Walmart owns Northwest Arkansas, but you also see other grocers there, like Harps, for example, that are expanding in Northwest Arkansas, kind of without that Kroger influence. So just as an example, the nearest store to Springdale, Arkansas, is well over an hour and a half away. And Kroger actually sold their locations in nearby Springfield, Missouri several years ago as well, leaving them without much of a Missouri presence at all. In fact, no locations in the Kansas City metro area. The nearest location would be in nearby Lawrence, Kansas, and just a few Gerb stores in central Missouri, leaving essentially most of Missouri untouched by Kroger. Now, that's just one example. There are other large swaths of the country that are untouched by a Kroger brand. So that's what we mean by eventually, if they're going to reach the entire U.S. population with some of these site-to-store and some of the click list offerings, they're going to need to either acquire stores or expand their brick-and-mortar footprint organically. That might take some time. So you're likely to see that expansion to 100% of the population be more closely linked to delivery-to-home type services. And even we still have questions regarding that and whether they can do that profitably and effectively at the cost of maybe building out some of their stronger areas in those terms.
One surprising thing that was mentioned was the role of employee retention in reducing selling, general, and administrative expenses. With margins such as this, Kroger must endeavor to limit expenses by any means necessary, Executive Vice President and CFO Mike Schlottman mentioned in the analyst Q&A that some of their reinvestment programs designed towards keeping staff, such as tuition benefits, for instance, are offset by an employee staying another 12 to 18 months with the company. You think about the amount of money that is spent every year on onboarding somebody. You have to do background checks. You have to do all sorts of things to vet the employee. And then what happens if they leave 4 to 5 months after that? That expense is pretty much gone. And while onboarding an associate is considered a sunk cost, you do want those employees, especially the better employees, to stay on a little bit longer. So this is really good. The investment is paying for itself, in other words. Another pleasant surprise was their pharmacy division, which is something we discussed earlier with Shopko Hometown. Their script count, they say, continues to grow. This has led to decreased marketing expenses for the division. They have to pay less in terms of ads because people are coming to their store. And as I always say, the least expensive customers are the ones you already have. And it seems as though the customers that are coming in and filling their scripts are pleased with the experience and the overall service that they're getting from Kroger. However, they did say that the Kroger specialty pharmacy was a hindrance to the gross margin rate, despite generating what they called very strong gross margin dollars simply because of the volume. Now we switch gears a little bit. In terms of looking ahead, Kroger expects adjusted earnings per share for the fourth quarter to be between 38 cents and 53 cents per share. And you can see that sort of a wide margin there. And after receiving pushback from Karen Short of Barclays on the wide range, McMullen, their CEO, said that much of this is driven by unknowns surrounding fuel and fuel margins. Even though they've divested a number of their convenience stores, fuel is still a large driver of revenue for them and profit for Kroger. Think about this. All of those fuel centers that they have that are adjacent, very close to the Kroger grocery stores, they still have those. So it is a very large driver of not only revenue, but snacks and things of that nature, a little bit of additional revenue that they can drive there. And that is why they can't really be a great predictor of fuel prices. We certainly aren't. We did not expect fuel prices to be where they're at towards the middle of December. Lows in my area, sub $1.80. You know, the national average is around $2 right now per gallon of gasoline.
Finally, we're going to reach over and touch on the arts and crafts retail space, which we don't do very often, as Michaels released quarterly results. Now, historically, we've been neither bullish nor bearish on the arts and crafts space or the fabric sales space, even though we've seen periods of both consolidation, as with Hancock Fabrics going bankrupt and then being bought out by Michaels, as well as growth, as with Hobby Lobby expanding now into smaller to mid-sized markets with expensive new build-outs. Now, I should mention before we get going with this story, I do harbor a bit of a dislike for Hobby Lobby because their front-end throughput is atrocious. Their cashiers seldom know discount percentages for sale items. All of these problems are caused by the fact that there are no barcodes on any products that Hobby Lobby sells, so everything must be input manually, causing multiple price checks per transaction. Horrendous lines this time of year as cashiers have to check the sale ad over and over again to see what is on sale and how much percent off it is. Anyway, that's beside the point. I want to move on to a retailer that actually uses some technology created in the last 25 years, which is Michaels. Again, they reported earnings for their third quarter on Thursday. Now, Michaels operates 1,256 Michaels stores and 36 Pat Catan stores. They actually closed one of their banners down at the beginning of the year, which we'll talk about in just a bit. As with Kroger, their share price initially sank on Thursday after the call before increasing to pre-call levels at the end of the day Thursday, only to fall in the larger market sell-off on Friday, leaving their price-to-earnings ratio at a modest 8.4 and their market cap sitting at $2.68 billion. But Leighton, as far as their earnings are concerned, they had market success over certain analysts' expectations and slight beats over others.
Yeah, they certainly did. The most notable beat over expectations came by way of same-store sales, which were up 3.8% over the third quarter of last year, a fairly robust number. Analysts expected just 2.2%. However, there is a caveat. While same-store sales metric sounds remarkable here with the 3.8%, given their particular niche in the arts and crafts arena, we should note that there was a date shift in the reporting period. They noted that if you were to actually compare sales over the same date range, the same-store sales would actually come in over just 1.1%. So again, keeping with the inflation theme here, we have seen more pronounced inflation in some of the categories Michaels dabbles in. So that may have made somewhat of an impact on these metrics too. So including inflationary impacts, it's likely sales were just about even year over year. And to this point, they saw an increase in average ticket, but a slight decline in transactions, which is always worrisome, especially during this time of the year or even during their third quarter here, where you're looking at least the calendar year, where you're seeing a lot of customers coming into stores where they don't ordinarily because they're already out and about. They're already shopping at retailers that are doing business maybe adjacent to Michaels. Their adjusted earnings per share was 48 cents compared to analyst expectations of 44 cents per share. Raymond James analysts did note that in their eyes, this beat was, and I quote, low quality after Michaels included a 1 cent exclusion for their adjusted earnings per share. But even after removing that 1 cent, simple math tells us they just beat by 3 cents. So really not all that bad, not a low quality earnings beat in our eyes, at least from the percentage difference. For whatever reason, they were bearish, Raymond James were, on the beat for other reasons, including better than expected same store sales, improved SG&A and share buybacks. And to be honest, Trent, all of these indicators usually are indicative of strong performance if the numbers bear out, and they do. So we have no idea for the reason for such bearishness by Raymond James. Sometimes analysts look for a reason to back up their previous sentiments about a retailer too. Raymond James has Michaels as just market perform, so perhaps this quarter didn't fit into their previous narrative, and so that's why they're saying what they are now. But further, the one-time exclusion here was a result of a legitimate inventory write-off due to a product from a third-party supplier that did not meet company standards, or at least standards that they're alleging were already outlined. And for this, they are pursuing legal action against the manufacturer. So it seems reasonable to exclude this as long as they exclude any settlement funds in the future. So you do have to look at the legitimacy again of this. This 1 cent write-off, while it isn't even that much, there were real reasons for it. This is something that they are pursuing for the midterm here and want to remedy. So Raymond James, they may have some thinking to do on the next earnings call as far as what they think about the company and its future. Sales for Michaels totaled $1.27 billion, Trent, beating expectations slightly of $1.25 billion. And we look at the notes from the call, we felt that Michaels was generally behind in omnichannel efforts, but they began to make increased headway in this quarter.
Now, buy online pickup in store traffic was higher sequentially, as were e-commerce conversion rates. Now, we should add the caveat that buy online pickup in store was just rolled out in the first quarter, so no surprise to see adoption increasing. Their focus has been centered around increased selection, including fabric. Now, the increased fabric selection, particularly on their e-commerce site, was a given with their acquisition of the Hancock Fabrics brand following their bankruptcy. The brand now exists as a subsection of the Michaels e-commerce site, and in fact, if you type in HancockFabrics.com into your browser, you're now rerouted to this page instead of the landing page that existed over a year ago that was saying that the new HancockFabrics.com was coming soon. Now, backing up to Michaels, even more crucial for their e-commerce efforts or their omnichannel efforts, their app is rated among the highest of all retail apps. They're 4.8 stars in the Apple Store. This is something that even seasoned e-commerce retailers struggle to do. Now, one thing Michaels has been doing more of lately in store, in brick and mortar, is increasing their seasonal square footage in stores with something they call a flexible merchandise area. The increased seasonal square footage was a major driving force behind their same-store sales beats, according to their CEO, Chuck Rubin. Rubin did note that a calendar shift as well, the same calendar shift Layton talked about over last year, caused an increase in Christmas merchandise being sold in the third quarter, but also that their fall and Halloween sales were up over last year if you compare same date over same date as a consequence of the increased square footage devoted to these items in stores. And that assisted in driving those overall sales numbers up. Going forward, they'll be looking to increase this flexible merchandise area, or FMA, in most of their stores. As of right now, the FMA increase has only hit certain stores in their pipeline. Now, this seems to be a reasonable strategy since, as we've discussed previously on the show, many specialty retailers, Party City among them, took a hit during Halloween, and it may be time to capitalize for Michaels or for other retailers on potential available market share, that's seasonal market share, before Walmart and Target, both of whom saw really robust Halloween sales, snatch it all up. Now, because of the increase in FMA and their efforts to bring in the more casual Michaels customer, they've expanded their ordering of seasonal merchandise for the holidays. So they're trying to boost inventory levels specifically of seasonal items. They're looking to stock more trees, so more of those Christmas trees this time of year, and are consolidating displays to make everything easier to locate for the casual customer. And I can certainly speak to the need for this. I went to a Michaels store recently to get garland in October and found it off in a remote area of the store rather than with the rest of the seasonal merchandise, which, just as someone that's been involved in retail, I found that incredibly confusing. It was kind of off in its own section rather than with the rest of the Christmas material. One thing that Michaels has also rolled out is oversized pieces in select stores. By that I mean something like a life-sized Santa's sleigh and a full-sized nutcracker that's around 6 feet, for example. And to me, this raises the question as to who would want a 6-foot-tall nutcracker. I'm thinking about just having to store it the rest of the year that you don't have it out for a holiday display, but Then again, I'm not exactly Michael's target demographic either. I'm just thinking about the logistics of storing a 6-foot-tall nutcracker the rest of the year. I think you got to have a pretty large attic for that. Anyway, just as the Container Store is attempting, they're rolling out one-stop gift-wrapped kits. Usually these are at a $5 price point to attempt to increase convenience for those casual customers, for those customers that don't go into Michael's the rest of the year, that maybe just go for the seasonal merchandise, maybe just go for the gift-wrapping capabilities there, or to purchase some gift-wrapping items. So the idea being they're trying to convert those casual customers to regular customers in this segment. This is an important time of year. We've talked on the podcast about how sometimes the holiday season is a little bit overstated as far as retention of future new customers. But in the arts and crafts segment, it's really not overstated, because this, along with the few other holidays that kind of go along with these seasonal concepts, absolutely crucial for businesses like Michael's, like Hobby Lobby, like Joann, to be able to execute so that they bring back customers time after time the rest of the year, the other 12 months out of the year. So because of the increase in seasonal SKUs, Michael's did roll out in-store geolocation to their phone app, something you don't see a retailer of this size doing a whole lot of, but it's similar to what we've discussed Walmart, Target, and Toys R Us is having done in the past. So a creative way certainly to use their phone app there, and perhaps one of the reasons why their phone app has been so successful. Now, we talked earlier in this story about Michael's closing down one of their brands. Back in the first quarter, Michael's closed 94 full-sized Aaron Brothers stores. Now, you can still get to the Aaron Brothers website via a link on the Michael's site, but Michael's was hoping that the closure of underperforming stores here in the Aaron Brothers portfolio would assist in margins and that customers would eventually find their way to Michael's. They did mention during the call that according to their data, the transference of customers was about what they thought it would be as of the third quarter. However, and more notable to us, excluding the impact of those closed stores, the company saw a revenue increase of 5%, or put another way, revenue from continuing operations jumped 5%, which is another reason why we were kind of confused as to why Raymond James and those analysts were so bearish on this call, because when you look at just the continuing operations, you cut out those stores that they closed because of underperformance, revenue did jump 5%, and you know, even though the same store sales numbers weren't all that great, their revenue from freshly opened stores does seem to be hitting at a fairly high level. So even if their comp store sales aren't great, their new store openings or their relocated stores seem to be doing just fine.
They, as most other retailers, are experiencing a squeeze on margins due to higher transportation expense. However, this seems to be mostly tied to their shift to a dedicated carrier model, which they hope will provide better predictability in the future and streamline cost. Additionally, they are moving to insourcing their e-commerce fulfillment, which caused $3 million in increased payroll expenses during the quarter. Speaking of which, one additional item they mentioned was their endeavor to move on from a third-party fulfillment provider. That's underway. This particular provider, Michael's, blamed for failure to meet expected demands during last year's holiday season. As such, Michael's has put in place plans for an internal fulfillment center based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. This is expected to be up and running by 2019, but you did get the impression that they were still somewhat concerned about using the third party again this holiday season. Generally speaking, we are still neither bullish nor bearish towards the retailer here. The drop in transactions is worrisome, but it does appear as though Michael's is well positioned to draw increased ticket sizes out of their current customer base. Again, their current customer is their most valuable one, particularly as app and omnichannel use improves throughout their stores. If nothing else, they appear to continue to grow via store openings with a net of 5 new stores in the third quarter. And by the way, they relocated 4 stores, nicer, cleaner stores. Overall, they have 19 additional Michael stores versus the same time last year. So 19 stores year over year. This is a retailer that, while we don't consider a growth company, certainly is doing very well in its own space.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast called Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead at one retail story we're keeping an eye on for the next week or the next month or year in retail. And we begin with Leighton.
So news that broke on Thursday of this week, Sears chairman Eddie Lampert, also the chairman of ESL Investments, submitted a $4.6 billion bid or proposal as such to save Sears, which, as we know, filed bankruptcy here recently, and to purchase 500 stores or up to 500 stores. You could argue that 500 stores, Trent, may be profitable for the long term, but this is a retailer that had over several thousand stores not that long ago. This is interesting because this is my looking ahead, because this might create some tension between a lot of the creditors that have come to the table, sort of requiring different things as far as this bankruptcy process is concerned. Some of Sears' creditors said they would actually rather not have Eddie Lampert even associated with the company at all going forward, and thus they rather just liquidate than take this $4.6 billion bid. So this is interesting to me because the bid isn't all in cash. ESL Investments doesn't have that cash just lying around. It's actually going to be based off of loan facilities, cash, and other different things they can use to get all of the money needed, cash collateral, for instance. So in my opinion, I don't necessarily know the details of this, but it seems as though from all of the news reports, this is probably not the best way to go for Sears because Eddie Lampert has provided no clear strategy going forward. Usually, typically, if you have a retailer that already is having trouble, maybe it's filed bankruptcy, maybe it's not, you get outside consultants in. The number one thing they talk about is it sustainable for the long term? And if so, how? How do we move forward with different things, different initiatives that can actually make this retailer profitable again? Eddie Lampert has never done that. He's never done that. So why would he do it going forward? So that's my looking ahead story, because there is still a lot of things going on here. Even, you know, talking of a stalking horse bidder, it doesn't necessarily mean that Sears is going to be around it by year 2020. Again, this is a retailer that we would hate to see actually shut all of their doors, but really management, new management has to be put in place, in our opinion, or at least in my opinion, to see this company succeed in beyond 2019.
Well, speaking of retail management, my looking ahead story honestly kind of makes me a little bit sad, because it was announced this last week that Amin Meredia, the CEO of Sprouts Farmers Market, will be moving on from the company. He said he just wanted to try something different. Nothing wrong with the company, nothing going on. But Meredia, if you've heard us talk about Sprouts in the past, we've loved his transparency. We loved his vision. He almost single-handedly, along with the rest of the leadership team and, of course, the entire organization at Sprouts, grew it from a fairly regional chain to something that's now not quite nationally ubiquitous, but a major competitor to Whole Foods. A lot of people would argue that they're out-competing Whole Foods in the natural food space, even though not everything they sell is 100% organic and that type of thing. But Meredia, always fantastically transparent on earnings calls, a very energetic leader. You couldn't help but get hyped about Sprouts Farmers Market when you heard him talk. And he said he'd been thinking about a transition, just moving on to something different for a little while. So really, it's a matter of two looking aheads here. First, who's the next person along that's going to kind of pick up where Meredia left off there at Sprouts, continue their growth plans and their growth platform? But my second looking ahead is now Meredia becomes an extremely sought after CEO. And you wonder which retailers are kind of looking at their current CEO and thinking about a bit of an upgrade. Now, there is a non-compete clause with someone else in the food or natural food space for a year. But I think Meredia is the type of CEO that could go in any retail business and fit pretty well. You think about other CEOs that have jumped ship. Ellison, of course, having some early growing pains there at Lowe's. But you wonder if he's not going to land at a retailer that'll now be very well positioned in the future. So we'll be keeping a close eye on both those things. Who's going to succeed him and where he ends up? Because at least for my money, I think he's one of the most sought after retail CEO free agents, if you will, now that he stepped aside at Sprouts. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. A reminder, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We'll be back 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.